Walkout tagout is one of the most important safety concepts in the workplace. Lockout tagout is the procedure that we use to control hazardous energy during processes like maintenance and inspections. The world we live in is powered by all sorts of energy sources. This energy powers our work. But if this energy isn't controlled, it can be dangerous and even deadly. This becomes especially important during maintenance activities like inspections and repairs. The way to control hazardous energy is by using lockout-tagout procedures. In lockout-tagout, the lock physically isolates the source of energy to prevent any accidental activation. The tag provides important information. Lockout procedures have four basic parts. Number one, identify hazardous energy sources. Number two, de-energize these sources. Number three, apply locks and tags to prevent unintentional startup during work. And number four, test the system to make sure energy isolation was successful. This is sometimes referred to as tryout. Then conduct your maintenance work safely. Once the work is finished, make sure you get everyone and all equipment out. Then you may remove the locks and tags and re-energize the system. Control energy hazards to keep yourself and your coworkers safe. Remember, lockout, tagout, and tryout to control hazardous energy sources.
Okay, so lockout, tagout, tryout. Keep in mind that if you're in a situation where you've got this equipment that could potentially start up, especially like, for example, in this case, you got the guy working inside on the rake. How is he going to know if somebody comes past outside, hits the button on the control panel and starts up the rake? Got no way to protect from that kind of stuff. Get your hands into a bad place, then you end up with some kind of an issue going on. There's, again, we've talked about electricity, we've talked about motion, we've talked about all sorts of different things that can go on. If guards are removed, if the guard is removed, then the system has to be locked out because the guard is no longer in place. We've talked about all the types of energy. Make sure that if it's something like capacitors and pressurized equipment that can relieve that pressure or that electricity, make sure that all of that is discharged and controlled so that that can't happen after you've gone ahead and locked something out. Write these procedures specifically for what your equipment is and for your locations. Here's an example. This is for a centrifuge. Each one of those colors, red, green, and blue, is a different lockout point in the system. Templates like this are available on the internet, or you can make your own. Go back and look at the lockout tagout seminar that was done 2 years ago here, and there's an example of how to do that and walk through that process on your own. Here's on the left, you can see that that's marked as the point for a lockout. In this case, the center photograph is actually this template of what needs to be done. It's on one of the pipes right in the middle of the piece of equipment that's being locked out. And make sure that your hasps and your locks and any of these other devices are right there where the equipment is, so there's no excuse for not having anything right there and ready to go. One thing to remember is that the locks have to be specifically identified in your business as lockout locks. They cannot be the same kind of lock that everybody's using for their toolboxes. The idea is that if somebody sees this lock, they say, "Oh, hands off, this is lockout, I can't touch this." Each person is assigned their own individual lock, may have more than one depending on what your situation is. Each lock can only have one key, and I have control of my lock, and nobody else can have it, because that means that nobody else can see the lock and say, "Oh, well, I need to turn on power to this." And they go find the key, remove the lock, and go ahead and power it up, and the next thing you know, we have an injury involved. Okay? Do you have to buy devices like this specifically? Are there any requirements that you have to buy the products from someone? No, there are not. You can make your own devices as long as they are difficult to defeat, right? Why spend a lot of money if you don't have to? Because you've got a great idea for a way to lock out your system. Especially if we're talking about those PLC control panels that in some cases become a startup point. Okay, so we've got what we're going to work on, we've got what the potential problem is, and then we've got engineering controls, which are things like these devices, and then we've got our written procedures and our SOPs, okay? We put those all together, and this is one of those examples where we use both engineering controls and we use administrative controls together to form the program. Is there any kind of a PPE that can take care of that for you? That's why PPE is always your last line of defense, right? Okay, so our question is, do you have a written procedure for safely entering brew house vessels for cleaning? The answer is... hit your Slido. I'm sorry? Okay, for those of you who say no, start working on that. We'll be glad to help. Ask questions of our group. Okay, Matt, you want to take this over and evolve lockout, tagout into how we're going to lock out vessels?
Thank you, Tony. That was a great, quick, high-level review of lockout, tagout. I will tell you that the safety subcommittee is working on a best management practice guidance document on that subject, so you'll have more detail available soon. Okay, confined spaces. So kind of closely related to lockout, tagout, because you can't really go in a confined space unless you've got those hazards controlled. You have to make that very safe to be in there. And also, like lockout, tagout involves many different kinds of energy, electrical, mechanical, gravity, fluid energy, chemical energy. So confined spaces, we run into the same thing. Real quickly, confined space accidents are uncommon, but they often have one very serious outcome, and that being fatality. So, you know, you don't usually get a scuff in a confined space accident. You usually get seriously hurt or maybe die. But they're very preventable. And so let's keep that number at zero. Right now, for craft breweries that we know of, there hasn't been a confined space fatality in about 10 years. But I'd like to see that never as a never KPI. A lot of people who die in confined spaces, by the way, are trying to go in and rescue their coworker, right? Imagine the reflex of my pal is in deep doo-doo right now. I'm going to help. It's a reflex. And you actually have to know enough to say, I'm not going to be the next victim. I'll do what I can from out here. It's a tough call. Here's what a confined space is. It meets three basic definitions. It's large enough so that you can get in it and perform some work duty. But it's hard to get in and out, and it's not designed for continuous human occupancy. What that means is it doesn't have, you know, your atmospheric controls, your temperature control, your fresh air control. Things like this room wouldn't be a confined space, right? Because it is designed for a continuous occupancy. And it certainly wouldn't be confined because there's plenty of easy ways in and out, and so that's what we're looking for. A confined space, hard to get into and out of, but it's possible, and it's not really designed for us to be in there for a long time. Now, when we add one more hazard to that basic definition, we end up with something that OSHA calls a permit-required confined space. And I'll be upfront with you right now, and that is, you don't go to the fire marshal for this permit. This is a permit you issue to yourself. It's basically a safe operating procedure that you're going to execute that says, okay, we've dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's before we enter this space, and we know who to call if we have a problem and all this stuff, right? It's a very pre-planned event to go into a confined space. And that's what the permit is. So when is this permit process required? Is when we add one more hazard to this place that's hard to get in and out of. And one of those possible hazards is a bad atmosphere. Okay, doesn't have to have a bad atmosphere at that moment. It has to have a reasonable potential of having a bad atmosphere. And in breweries, of course, we have vessels that have carbon dioxide as their primary constituent. Say an empty fermenter, you just ran the beer out to Bright Beer Tank or something, right? And you've got a tank full of CO2. Right? That's oxygen deficient and too much CO2. Always think of, when you're thinking about the atmosphere in a confined space, think about it this way. If there's a gas that's built up, there's also oxygen is displaced. You always have two, right? If you have a flammable vapor, you have less oxygen. If you have too much nitrogen, you have less oxygen. Too much carbon dioxide, less oxygen. So there's always a parity like that. The next thing you're looking for is what we call an engulfment hazard. So if you have bulk grain silo or a spent grain silo, this is a permit-required confined space, no two ways about it, for a couple of reasons. One is because it has the engulfment hazard. You can get swallowed up faster than you can swim out of this. I mean, don't fool yourself. And the weight of the grain on your chest prohibits you from intaking a breath. Okay, not to mention what goes down into your respiratory system and your windpipe just in the terms of malt. So it's actually probably a quicker way to go, I guess, if we want to, you know, go there. Water can also engulf, but we're usually talking about grain. And then oftentimes grain silos have a second hazard in them. Notice this one on the right here. And that is inwardly converging walls. Have you ever seen these in a brewery? Heck yeah, right? CCV fermenters all have this. And anything that has this inwardly converging wall in a larger fermenter, now 7-barrel maybe not, but you know, in 20-barrel and above, you could be down in that cone and not be able to reach anything to get yourself out. And guess where carbon dioxide likes to accumulate? See? Now you see I've given you these examples of how in confined spaces it's very easy to have 1, 2, 3, 4 different hazards happening at once. And then OSHA's catch-all is any other recognized serious safety or health hazard. Remember, safety is about injury, health is about occupational disease or something like that. So any kind of hazard like that. The obvious one that stands out to me is agitators in the brewhouse vessels. Okay, so a permit-required confined space requires a lot of extra stuff be taken into account if one enters it. What does it mean to enter a confined space? The answer might surprise you. It is when any part of your body passes through the plane of the opening of the space. All right? So here's our intrepid Andy taking a peek into a fermenter. He's not breaking the plane of the manway opening. He has not entered it. The person with the mash rake is using a tool. They haven't gone in. They haven't broken the plane. A tool is a great way to avoid entering a permit space or any confined space. The third one here, we're doing CIP, and we're managing to stay outside of the plane of the opening. But in the fourth example, the individual's inside the mash tun and or the louder tun and has certainly broken the plane. But the real rub here is when you're doing cleaning in the cellar and you want to stick your hand inside the fermenter, maybe to remove the gasket so you can do a cleaning or inspection on the gasket. Or you want to stick your head in there with your flashlight and make sure that the dome is clean of Croizon or that your PRV or your spray ball are clean. Okay? So you have to be creative about how to do that without actually entering, and that could even be your hand. Now, OSHA didn't write this rule thinking only about fermenters, and we look at a fermenter and go, nothing's going to bite my hand if I put it in there to take that gasket off. But it wrote the rule for anybody who had a confined space. So imagine spaces where there's a mechanical hazard in there you couldn't see, where something could fall on your hand, those kind of things. So that's why that's the definition of entry. So if you have a confined space that has at least one of those other hazards, it's a permit space, and if you're going to enter it, as I've just mentioned, you have to go through a ton of requirements. And I'm not going to go into those requirements because I'll tell you right now, there's no reason any brewer in this room should be going into a permit-required confined space in your brewery. Okay? And I'll explain that further as I go along here. But a permit-required confined space you should not ever go into, meaning, and I'm going to use a fermenter as an example, a fermenter with CO2 atmosphere in it. Okay, what happens if you have a pinhole leak in the inner jacket and you're losing glycol into your product? You have to send a fabricator in there, right, with the stainless steel welding gear and have them fix that. I don't care if you've got the greatest stainless steel fabricator working at your brewery. If they're not an expert in confined space entry, hire it out. Just like Rachel said with cranes, don't try to do too much with a forklift. Don't get over your head. When it comes time for the big stuff, hire a rigging company. And just like here, when it comes time to go into a permit-required confined space, hire experts to do that work. Okay? Now, you're thinking, but I do go into some kind of confined spaces in my daily operations. I'm okay with that. I understand that. But let me show you how you need to think about it and document it. You don't want to have to go into all this rigmarole, so I'm going to give you two options. The first one is called what we say reclassification. What are we reclassifying? Well, we have a permit-required confined space in, say, a louder tun. Why? It's hard to get in and out of. I can get in there to do my work. It's not designed for my continuous occupancy. So it's a regular confined space. It has another serious recognized hazard, the mash rake. Okay? So it is a permit-required confined space. So on that basis, that's a permit-required confined space. You should never go in that louder tun to clean up the grain bits and lift out the plates and do whatever it is you have to do that we all do as brewers. So how do you justify that? Well, what if I can eliminate that mash rake hazard from outside of the vessel using Tony's lockout tagout, and then that other serious hazard no longer exists? I've locked out the rake. It cannot come on. I have the key in my pocket to prove it when I go in there and do my final inspection. It cannot come on. The hazard no longer exists. So now I don't have a permit-required confined space anymore because I don't have the other hazard. Yes, I can get into it and do my work. It's hard to get in and out of, and it's not designed for continuous occupancy, but it's not a permit space because I got rid of the hazard that made it a permit space. That's reclassification. Now, anybody who goes into their vessel that has an agitator like this has already understood that in some way. But if you don't have a lockout program formalized and you don't have a procedure and you don't actually lock out the power supply, right, if you don't document that, then OSHA would say that's a permit-required confined space and you're in there without a permit and you don't have a program and let me get out my ticket book. Okay, so it comes back again full circle to documentation. I did a hazard assessment. I know that the hazards that could be in there when I'm doing that work are the agitator comes on, or somebody turns on the CIP cycle and hot water comes on my head, or whatever. Your mileage may vary. But find out what those hazards are in your hazard assessment process, defeat them with lockout, tagout, institutionalize that into an SOP, and you're good to go. And you're actually doing the work almost the way you used to do it. You've got a little bit more documentation now. When you have a new employee or you're bumping the seller person over to these activities on the brew deck, you've got a training material that is your SOP. And if OSHA comes knocking, you've done a hazard assessment and you've got a procedure and it's a reclassified space. Here are the rules for reclassification. It can have any hazard and multiple hazards as long as you control them from outside the space first using lockout tagout, and it does not have an atmospheric problem. Brew house vessels don't, unless your brew house is in a cellar, in a basement, and your CO2 cellar is above it, and CO2 leaks down into your cell basement where your brew, I mean, you would have to, right? How do you get CO2 into the brew house vessels? And if you don't have that screwy circumstance, then you don't have an atmospheric problem in the brew house, so you're good. The other way around, let's say, the other alternative to a permit-required confined space is what we call alternative procedures. And that is where there are no other hazards except an atmospheric hazard. That's not common in a brewery, but it's common in utility manholes. You've seen the cable person down under the street, right, working by themselves. And what do you notice? They have an exhaust tube, right? It looks like an exhaust tube. They're actually blowing fresh air down into the manhole. And that's the only hazard there is potential atmospheric problem. And they've got atmospheric monitoring. See? So they're controlling that hazard. If the atmospheric alarm goes off, they are trained to bail. Get out. That's a legitimate process. And it means it's not a permit space. When you have a permit space, you've got three people minimum doing the work. When you have a reclassified space, an individual can go do it by themselves as part of their job. So that's the big lesson there. It's all down here in a little bit more detail, and we do have a best management practice available to you that the subcommittee produced, and it's super. And right now, because, you know, we're in the fourth quarter here, let's get a little blood flowing. I'm going to bring Rachel up.
All right, everybody, we are so close. We're in the home stretch. And speaking of stretching, we are going to get up. We're going to wake up again. I've been in your seats a few years ago, and I was asleep at this point. So sorry. But yeah, so let's do it. Let's stand up. Stretch. Make some stretch to the side if you need to. Whatever's feeling sore, whatever you need to do. And we're gonna take it up a notch, guys. All right, come on. Time when you're running out of it. Whew, let's move on. Oh, so not worth that. Thank you, guys. All right. Just a reminder, you want to document your training. You've made it this far. You just had to watch me do that. Definitely take this quiz. I know you all can pass it. Take it by midnight tonight. Let us know if you need some special accommodations for it. There we go. And safety six-pack. Just a reminder, if you enjoy this six-pack in person, you can get it to go. Once you take your quiz, you'll get a link, and you'll have access to what we're calling a playlist, and it's tons of resources that relate to the six subjects we're about to get into. Now, I'm going to start with COVID. It may be 2021, but it is still COVID-19, guys. It is still happening around us, even though a lot of people are vaccinated, a lot of people aren't, and the Delta variant is going around. Obviously, the tasks are going to be human interaction that are putting you at risk, and the hazards are the transmission of the virus. However, in trying to prevent this spread, you might be using some chemicals that you don't normally use, or specifically employees, like front-of-house employees, who don't normally use chemicals might be using them. So the best thing that you can really do here is make sure you are doing training for all your staff. If you're getting new staff, if you're having hiring issues like everybody, make sure you are taking the time to train all those new staff members on any hazard. And then if you're having hiring issues in the back and you're having front-of-house employees do some swing duty and learn, like learning packaging and stuff for you, definitely make sure you are taking the time to give those employees the safety training they need. And PPE is very important here. It's, again, we always say it's our last line of defense, but for the transmission of the virus, it is a very important line of defense, not just for ourselves, but for everyone around us, our coworkers, our customers. We want people to still be able to come buy our products, so we need to take care of them. These are all things that I think we know. We have heard this over and over again, and so the best thing I can do right now is remind you that we have so many resources. They are also free, like all the safety resources on the BA. Here are just some of them. And then quick note, if anybody did have to shut down their brewery and still has not restarted it, we also have resources for how to restart equipment after a long period of shutdown. And we are going to do one more quick Slido poll. Since being faced with COVID-19, have other safety programs in your workplace worsened, remained the same, or improved? That's pretty cool. That's good. Anything for improvement? Cool. All right. That seems like a lot of responses. So cool. Good to know. Let's move on. The next beer in the six-pack is mental well-being. I like to use the term well-being instead of just health because the definition of well-being incorporates health. It is about your health, your happiness, and your prosperity. Again, we are running out of time, so I'm going to breeze through this, but it is such an important topic. This relates back to what we talked about with company culture. You need to provide, employers need to provide a workplace free from harm, and that includes harm that comes from mental issues. Mental distractions equal physical injuries in the workplace. I don't think that we can think of a single example of a workplace accident that doesn't include, I was distracted, or I was thinking about something else. There are a lot of potential hazards that are associated with not being aware of mental well-being of yourself and of people around you. You can have a toxic work culture. You might have one bad apple, and that one bad apple is literally lowering the bar for everyone else at your job. And when they aren't doing that, they might literally be impeding people's abilities to do their job. And then, of course, there's also losing an employee because they quit or potentially even self-harm. We do work in a very intense industry. A lot of us have probably felt burnout before. We're under a lot of pressure, and that adds up. And especially with the state of the world right now, with COVID, with all these social justice issues finally coming to a point, we've hit the point where we can't go backwards. We have to address this stuff, and we have to be aware of it. We're all humans. We all have feelings. We all get nervous about talking about these feelings, but it's really important. And the best thing that we can do is practice it, is practice communicating and learning how to do it appropriately. I'm going to keep moving through this, but it's important to know this week happens to be Suicide Prevention Week. This is true all the time, but I think especially since COVID, we are all under a lot of additional stress, and it really is worth it to take the time to check in with your coworkers, to be aware of how they might be behaving, and to be aware of yourself. And again, practice, practice, practice. You might not have a good vocabulary for expressing how something is making you feel, or you might have learned to suppress your emotions rather than be upfront about them. but we all work better together when we are able to talk and able to be open. And just because someone is open with you doesn't mean that you are now responsible for solving their problems. You can do this while maintaining healthy boundaries. If you are very interested in this, I am running a seminar called Talking About Talking. We're going to start the discussion on mental well-being. That is going to be Saturday. It's going to be a lot more detailed information on how to have conversations like this, on who in your brewery should be responsible for ultimately making sure everyone's well-being is taken care of. And a lot of it is geared towards breweries that don't have a dedicated HR department, because most of us are small and we don't, and we don't have that background training on how to deal with these things. And the last thing I will say about this is if you break your arm at home, you still come to work with a broken arm. And so I think we need to get rid of this misconception of like, oh, if you're struggling with something like financially or you had a death in the family, you just got to check that at the door. You got to not let that impact your work. That's not possible. I think we've all been there and we're just putting on a mask and underneath it, we are still really distracted and we're not engaged with our work. And so, yeah, I think we need to be really thinking about mental well-being and mental health as an actual physical thing that will impact us. And that is it for me. And it's time for beer number three.
All right, beer number three. Yeah, beer number three. Sound good, doesn't it? I'm feeling pretty good. So, beer number three is about preparedness. This is National Preparedness Month for workplaces. Did it last time, too. So, what do you want to be prepared for? Anybody had problems because of the forest fires? Raise your hand. Anybody have problems because of the hurricane coming through? Raise your hand. How about the tornadoes that came through with the... Okay, how about the flooding that came through? Is there anything that we don't need to be prepared for? So, you need to have a plan. We highly recommend that you put it in writing because you're going to need to train everybody on it, right? One of the things that we don't talk about enough, I don't think, and keep in mind, this isn't just for our workplaces, but this is something that you should also carry to home, and that's this concept of what's going to happen if something does happen and everybody scatters. How are you going to regroup? How are you going to bring everybody back together, find out that everybody's in good shape, okay? Keep in mind, those tornadoes blew through and they took down cell towers. Can you count on your cell phone? Can you count on your network to be up so that you could post on Facebook? Remember that under these circumstances, a lot of this is going to change, so have alternative plans that don't include those things that we rely on all the time, okay? When you go through these emergency plans, and there's basic information that's available right now through all of the OSHA platforms, you can also bring in the aid of FEMA. You can bring in the emergency websites. Also talk to your local responders. Get their help and support for how to pull this information together. And then just look at all those standard things that you need to have. Make sure you got your first aid kits. Consider whether or not you need to have burn gel and products like that in those kits. Make sure that your eye wash and shower systems are available and work properly. Sorry, I'm trying to rush. We're getting late. I want to get to beer number four. So we've already talked about all those natural disasters and everything. Don't forget some of the stuff that's going on when it comes to violence. Look at the I Love You Guys Foundation page. It was for a young girl who the last thing she texted her family was, I love you guys, before the Bailey High School shootings. It'll give you some good ideas of ways to put together a program to talk about what you're going to do if something happens in your workplace. All right, beer number four.
We're on pressure, so we'll call this beer a foamer. There's lots of pressure hazards in the workplace. So whether that's your CO2 bulk or in your beer or fermenting. So when we look at tasks with pressure, we look at moving beer around, cleaning kegs, CIPing. Whether it's under pressure or not, we can create that pressure by closing things off. So outcomes that can happen, tank implosion. So you see our tanks are not rated for vacuum, and it doesn't take a lot of vacuum to see that violent reaction, which we'll show a quick video of here in a little bit. You can have chemical spraying out. You can have tank explosion as well, along with asphyxiation. CO2 expands over 500 times from liquid to gas if you have any liquid CO2 on site. That can overtake an area and push the oxygen out of it very quickly. Also looking at burns and any traumatic injuries. Controls, we use gauges. We want to pay attention to what's going in, having primary and secondary regulators, so we're not just regulating one thing. We have some redundancy built into the system. You can hear me use that several times in this next 5 minutes, will be redundancies. So same with pressure and vacuum relief. Have redundancies. Don't just have one way of relieving that. Have a couple set up. Have your permanent one on top of your tank and maybe one on your setup on the bottom. So you do have some pressure relief there. If things go awry, whether that's burst discs or just our standard pressure relief valves. And then making sure we're just using our proper fittings and taking care of things. Would you want to take in front of that hose? So that's a pretty traumatic injury if a fitting's not right. Or you used a worm clamp to hold that hose together because the end wasn't sealing right, so you cut it off and worm clamped something else on. So making sure you use the right fittings, you're looking at your hoses, and when you do find damage to your hoses, you're taking them out of service. Really, really important, not being like, oh, I think I could get one more out of this. Take that out of service and move on. You can see some of these catastrophic failures, particularly vacuum failures. You can see on both of these tanks, that's what it looks like happened to me. And then we've got some hose blowouts as well.
They show up, we fill them up with beer, and the things just start leaking out the manway right away. Beer's just flowing out the manway because of the pressure on it, and obviously there wasn't a good seal. We start just jimmying these things. We go into the deli and we take spoons and forks and knives and we start pounding and wedging, using them as wedges in the manways so that when we fill them up with beer, the pressure of the beer on that manway, with the wedges into it, would not allow the beer to seep through. And it worked, but it looked like absolute shit because people would come into the brewery and here's all these tanks with like all these utensils just wedged into the manway. So we obviously didn't order any of those tanks as life went on, but it helped us get from point A to point B. Since then, obviously, we've realized that it doesn't work to cut corners to make quality beer. You need quality equipment.
Christian Lewis, Master Brewer in Residence for the Paul Mueller Company. Today we're going to demonstrate what happens if you hot CIP a tank and follow that hot CIP with a cold rinse. We're going to use a 55-gallon drum here with hot water in it to demonstrate our tank being hot CIP'd. So here we have our model tank that's been hot cleaned, and now we're getting ready to rinse with cold water. I have it sealed up, and this demonstrates what happens when you have improper vacuum relief. Now we're going to rinse it with cold water and watch what happens. So that's vacuum failure, hot CIP, cold rinse. And if that doesn't stress the importance of a proper vacuum relief valve, then I don't know what will.
A wall of water coming into the door. The
tank just exploded.
Holy fuck. Well, look at the I-beam.
What happened to the door?
Oh my God.
Guys, guys. Guys, come on. Let's go outside.
So you can see we've got three types of pressure that we're talking about here. We had hydrostatic in the first video, talking about how we don't want to cut corners. We want to make sure that you're getting good equipment and that equipment is going to work for you. Second video, we're looking at vacuum relief. Now imagine that tank is how big, you know, whether it's at Bell's and you got an 800 barrel tank or a 40 barrel tank, when that implosion happens, that thing is likely going to tip over, and that is super, super, super dangerous. It is a violent reaction. People don't think about vacuum that way. Also, then you got your overpressurization, so they didn't have relief on that, and I think that the guy dropping the F-bomb properly described that as just, wow, like that blew through a wall, through an I-beam. So pressure relief, super, super critical here. A little just briefly talking about pressure systems, just making sure we have redundancies, making sure we have SOPs to follow so we don't have a hot tank that's receiving cold, or we don't have caustic and CO2 mixing in a tank and causing some of those dangerous, dangerous situations. Here's a couple devices. Look into it. You can always reach out to us or the engineering subcommittee if you have questions about your particular device. There's a lot on the market that can get the job done well. This pressure does not just exist on the brewing side or in the cellar side. It also can be during packaging. So here's an example of a procedure failure where he's lucky he caught the edge of that instead of the brunt of it, because look at it shoot across the room. So things like keg, all packaging really, it says keg cleaning and filling, but canning, bottling, draft systems are under pressure. So making sure that we do have the right regulators, we can also have the hoses and hazards addressed. Engineering controls are important for this. So looking at again, redundancies in our system, but also guarding. So we've got all, Kraft is switching very much so to cans, but bottles explode. That's just something that happens at the beginning and end of run. So having proper guarding around those fillers, it will happen. And you do best to guard that with like those plexiglass guards, making sure we have the right preventative fittings and we're not using worm clamps there. Also super critical. Procedurally, following SOPs, understanding how to depressurize the system before we're taking things apart to clean, and knowing all of our operating pressures of our equipment where they belong. So if I walk up to a pressure gauge and it says 40 pounds, is that where it's supposed to be? Is it supposed to be at 100? Is it supposed to be at 20? So labeling can really help with that as well. I'm going to swing it up for a different pressure situation here for our fifth beer and Chris on dry hopping.
I hope you liked all those beers. I got the dry hopped version. Little video going here.
We can't do it.
There's nothing to be done.
Hey, Marty, are you still going to a boring event? Sorry, Marty, there's nothing you can do about it, man.
Smells like hops in here.
Very poor use of the ladder there as well. I don't know if you can see, but there's a sign on the wall that said, have a nice fall. Good thing he didn't. Nothing can be done once it started, sure, but you can definitely prevent that. Preventing the geyser, besides the embarrassment of everybody in the taste room watching that happen, and then everybody posting it on social media, please don't do that, but it happens, I know. Why does it happen? Well, did you blow down that tank? Don't forget that there's residual CO2 that's dissolved in that beer. So the hazards, besides the embarrassment factor, you could get hit by something flying off the tank, of course. There's a lot of CO2 that's coming out there. At some of the lower thresholds of CO2 will give you a headache and affect your mood and do a lot of things before you even asphyxiate and succumb to it. It's a lot more than just the oxygen. Having a meter clipped to your shirt can help you with that. Standing outside of the line of fire, just keeping your distance. You don't breathe that gas there. That last guy, I'm so glad he didn't fall off that ladder, but don't be standing on the top two steps of the ladder. You should be using a ladder that's twice the size of that one. A-frame ladders are probably the worst selection of ladder that you can use. An extension ladder would be much better. It going 3 feet above the... It's locked in with the ladder hooks and everything. Scissor lift would be even better. If you're smaller like me, you're probably going to use a ladder. We have PPE listed on there, fall protection. You're not going to use fall protection typically with a ladder. If you're on a scissor lift or you have some other engineering thing for larger tanks. I don't want you to think that you need to get fall protection just to climb a ladder, but you do still wear your glasses and your slip-resistant boots. Bump cap might help if you got something flying off the tank as well. Engineering controls, you can consider a hop recirculation device or a hop torpedo, or I don't know, maybe just a suggestion here, don't brew fruit smoothie beers. I don't know, that's just me, but I'm just saying. The procedure is where you prevent the geyser from happening. Blow down the tank first. Make sure that there's no pressure on there. Be aware of what CO2 is dissolved in it. Make sure your pressure gauges are working, your PRVs are working. Don't exceed the volume design. Are you overfilling your fermenters? They're supposed to have 25 to 35% free headspace at the top. I know we want to make more beer, but is it worth killing your cellarman? Or injuring him? I think not. It would really help if you don't dump the hops in all at once. I know we're in a rush too, but if you just add it slowly, you could start to see gas evolving, and that's the time when you could prevent it, recap it really quick, and wait till it settles down. That's a simple, safe working procedure. Maybe if you have to fill kegs, do a CIP, and dry hop a tank all at once, maybe say, hey, boss, I need to slow this down a little bit. It's unsafe to do all these things at the same time. Take your time and do it right. Be safe. Other than that, you can think about maybe not using that ladder. Get a scissor lift, rolling platform. Those rolling stairs with the platform on top, those are really great to get. Definitely worth the investment. Catwalk, if you're a certain size, would be really great. That's not just... Your general contractor putting some plywood at the top. It's engineered with hand railings. That's the type of catwalk I'm talking about. And that's when you would use your harness, anchor, tether, etc. Okay, and I'm going to toss it over to Matt for our sixth beer.
Okay, kettle boilovers. I'm going to ask for the scary show of hands. Who's ever had one or has firsthand knowledge of somebody who's experienced kettle boilover? Look around. The correct number of hands is zero, okay? This is not acceptable, and I'm going to get kind of hard-ass on you about this.
Two minutes ago.
fellow on the mezzanine says, yeah, I just looked in that 3 minutes ago. Okay, so boilovers happen quickly. We can understand that. We'll get to the you know really why they happen here in a second, but they happen during wort boiling activity in general, but often during hop addition or special additives that you're adding into the kettle. And the hazards that a wort boilover presents are deep, serious burns. And we're talking, to use common language, second and third degree burns that go beyond the surface of the body down deeper into your tissues. If the body is over 30% covered by a second or third degree burn, there becomes a likelihood of dying. And there's actually a formula that doctors use based on your age, because the older you are, the less likely you are to survive from an injury like this. And there are two things that really catch up with you. One, obviously, is the burnt skin and all the reparation that has to go with that. But secondly, and you may not know this, is latent organ failure. Because your body opens up a whole can of immune whoop-ass on a big burn. It opens up so much immune property that you can have too much immune action going on. And I'm going to use the term you've heard about during COVID, cytokine storm. This cytokine storm is basically your immune agencies going overboard and causing organ damage as a byproduct of that. So you may survive the burns 2-3 weeks in a burn unit, and then your kidney fails, your liver fails, your heart stops, and you die. So let's just take it that's we're not going down that road. How do we avoid going down that road? Well, for one thing, we do is we avoid overcharging the kettle. And you know, I almost lost my noodle the other night when I heard somebody say at dinner, "Yeah, we knock out 24 barrels of hot wort out of our 20 barrel kettle." And I didn't know if I was just supposed to leave dinner or rip the guy's head off. Like that, and he was doing it like bragging rights, okay? There's freeboard in a kettle, at least 50% more than hot wort volume. That's not your real estate. That belongs to the beer. Do not do this. If you're profit motive driven and that's the unsafe decision you've made, you need to reprice your product. Don't go there. And you don't have foam controls, or you're adding hops too rapidly, or you forgot some basic homebrewing sense about there's a hot break reaction that happens when the first hops get boiled for a few minutes and they act as an anti-foam agent. And I'll double down on the hazy milkshake beers or whatever. If you're brewing beers that have a lot of starchy grain, high protein grains in it, right, oats and so forth, and you're not adding a bittering addition, you've got double the problem here, right? And if you're running high volume through your brew system higher than you should be, you've got too much wort, it's a very foamy wort, and you don't have the benefit of that hot break hop reaction where the bitter acids knock down the foam. So if we go back and we look at serious boilovers where there have been injuries, and we actually have a number of cases where we know what the beer was being brewed, they're double IPAs and they're hazies, okay? And so it's a complication of factors. So brew to volume and use the proper controls. Some of the controls I want to talk about, a foam cutoff switch. If your kettle didn't come with one, and many still don't, it's buyer beware. You need to install one. You can install one for a few $100 by buying the right sensor, usually a conductivity sensor. There are also some level sensors, and the Brewers Association Engineering Subcommittee is currently engaged in an R&D project that's going to result in a manual of how to inexpensively add a foam control device to your kettle. What this foam control device does is it detects foam before it gets to the manway, and it turns off your heat supply instantly. And when the foam subsides, your heat supply can return. Using an anti-foam agent, if you don't, you really need to. Don't worry about it affecting downstream beer, because many experienced brewers that you'll talk to say using foam control additives in the kettle actually ends up producing better product in the end. Keeping a hose handy. Some of these older systems don't even have any way of knowing what the actual temperature in the kettle is, right? We want to see a digital display on our panel that has the temperature in the kettle. This is especially important when we're coming up to heat after we're just finishing runoff. And that's because we're adding all the steam we can at once, right? Bottom jacket, side jacket, everything on full. Let's get to boil. Let's get busy on our 60 minutes or whatever we're doing. It's a time thing. Well, if we, and a lot of boilovers happen right at this moment because we've left all the steam on, we hit boiling and keep going right on past it, and we don't have the hot break yet. So be on, my rule is if steam is running, there's a brewer on the deck. And automated systems, you know, have taken out a lot of those worries. But for those of you operating on largely manual brew houses, if steam is running, there's a brewer on the deck or very nearby. So stick to your design volume. Don't stand in front of the manway. I've seen designs where there is no place safe on the brew deck. These very compact systems, there's no safe place where you can't get out of way of that. Develop an SOP. And always just a little bit of that extra PPE consideration here. Eye protection for sure. Heavy gloves are good if you're coming in contact with hot surfaces there. And remember to keep your pant legs over your boots. They will provide quite a lot of shedding of hot wort if it were to get on your pants. If you're wearing shorts in the brewery, stop it. Don't do it. Don't argue with me about it's hot in the brewery, okay? Chefs wear long pants. Firemen wear ridiculous clothes when they run into buildings. Go to a foundry. How about hazmat technicians? They all deal with the protective equipment that's necessary for the job, and brewers need to get on that bus and ride it, okay? Please. I don't mean to end this on like a bust your balls note, but get rid of the shorts, okay? And stop whining about the heat. Take breaks, hydrate, get used to the heat, and find opportunities to reduce your exposure to that heat, okay? That's how you do it. Now, I want to say here, we don't have the URL in the slide, but guess what? While we've been conducting class today, it's been added to your conference app. So your quiz URL is now in the conference app. When you go there at the end today to give us a review, and please be nice, you can also get that URL, and then you can take the quiz and get your certificate. We're going to thank, big thanks here for Burco for being our proud sponsor today. Head on over to booth 1424 and catch up with Dana. See this handy bottle opener he's got that looks like a medal. Get one of those for free, and thank Burco for sponsoring today. And then we want to give big hugs to Pit Viper for our safety glasses that we've given out today. Also, Trademont, we've got a couple more prizes, so don't run away. And Blafa Kegs for our props, and also Origin Malt. So thanks for those guys. And finally, just as a couple of key points, come on up, crew. You got to talk about safety. Normalize it. It should not be something that feels awkward. If it feels awkward, you're doing it right because you're beginning the conversation. Have those conversations. And remember, there's no caste system with safety. Everybody, if safety is needed because of the activity, then everybody needs to be on the same page and do the same things. Come and meet us tomorrow at Safety Social, room 404, right? Page not found. Well, find us at room 404. You can remember that, 3:30. We've got placards to give you, safety glasses, and we'll chit-chat over a beer. And set a good example on your social media. We're going to just wind down here with one more pitch to come talk to us if you're interested in being part of the safety subcommittee. And we're going to get to our lightning Q&A round right now. And what I'm going to do here is I'm just going to... I'm going to go to the handheld mic, Marcus. Here we go. A little more. Okay. And I'm going to look at Slido. You've been busily adding questions here the whole time, which is fantastic. And I'm going to just walk and talk with while I'm doing this. I noticed that somebody named Will here asked us a question. What's the best all-around glove type? And Will, are you still in the room? Can you raise your hand if you are? Will? There's Will. Rachel's going to give you a choice of a couple of prizes for asking the most highly rated question, which was, what's the best all-around glove type used when handling common brewery chemicals? We're going to try to answer each one of these questions in 10 seconds or less, okay? Go ahead, Chris.
Nitrile and neoprene, like these. These ones right here.
You can take your mask down, too, when we're doing this. You can't hear. Okay, and we got Will all squared away. Will? All right, does anyone own up to this question? Are there good online resources for prescription safety glasses? Who asked that in the first place? Right, way over there, Rachel, you see him? That's a really good question. Anybody want to take that? I'll take it. Okay. As a wearer of prescription safety glasses, the best thing to do is go to your local optometrist, support your local business, and ask them. They may not have them on display, but they can get them. There are several brands. I'm not trying to give a plug here, but the most common brand that people use is Titmus, T-I-T-M-U-S. That's not an endorsement. But you can see that they come with side shields like this. They come in a variety of different color coordinated colors. You can get progressive lenses in them. Larry has his brand that he wears. You can also go to an online eyeglass. I'm out of time. Okay. Great question. Thank you for that. Okay, let's see what else we have. Cesar asked, does anyone know who to contact in Illinois for a free OSHA consultation? Illinois State OSHA does not cover private employers. That's true. Illinois has a split system, and private, you know, private employees who would work for a brewery are covered by federal OSHA. So federal OSHA has a headquarters in Chicago. It's Region 6, and if you go to OSHA Illinois, it'll direct you to consultation. Let's see, what other good ones do we have here? Zoe, Zoe, are you still here? Zoe's right there, okay. Do we have any more safety glasses, Rachel? This was a good one. Does the BA maintain a list of recommended industry PPE for brewing operations? Chris?
Yes, we do. There's a BMP. You can search for it under the Resource Hub.
Super. Good stuff. We have a whole booklet we put together on that. Here's a toughie. Bearwolf asks, my brewmaster is having us run CO2 through our carb stones in the brew tank, in the bright tank, while we're reaching in the tank to add adjuncts. So CO2 atmosphere is changing in a confined space, and we're reaching in the tank to add adjuncts. How can I convince him to stop this process? First of all, this activity is taking place within a permit-required confined space. No question about it. So anybody want to take a stab at that? Tony.
8 seconds.
Real simple. You just have a conversation with them. That's the first starting point. And then you point out the fact that CO2 is not just an asphyxiant. It also has health effects. If you heard the CO2 seminar that we did with ASPC... Bring chemists, MBAA, and I was involved as the BA member.
Also, thanks, Tony. Whistleblowing is anonymous.
Yep, that's true.
And then I'll add my 2 cents, and that is stop and get a group of people together and stop and say, okay, I understand what the outcome is here. We're trying to add an adjunct without oxidizing the product. How else could we do it that doesn't involve us entering the space by sticking our hands in? Great question.
Try pushing in with a corny keg.
I have a 10-barrel mash tun. After grains are pulled, do I need to a permit confined space just to pull the false bottom out? The answer is you need to reclassify it because it starts out as a permit-required confined space until you make it otherwise. So you do that reclassification process by saying, here's how I'm going to go in it safely by locking out everything that could happen to me while I'm in it. And then you're okay to go in it, as long as there's not an atmospheric hazard, which there wouldn't be with that. How often can I expect OSHA to check out my brewery? Andy.
This is going to be our last question, too. I'm just keeping time for us. They're going to randomly inspect or on a complaint. It's really, really, really random, I would say. In states where it's a focus, it's going to be a lot more frequently, maybe every 5 years, though, is still pretty frequent for the limited resources to come around.
So the upshot of it is do it for yourself, not for worries of OSHA. All right, listen, everybody, thank you for staying. You've been great. I hope this really hit home for you and you take some good ideas back to your breweries. Thanks a lot. We're going to kick it around up here if you want to chat with us while we're putting things away. Thanks for your attention, and make it a safe year next year, and hopefully see you at a future safety event at the Brewers Association Craft Brewers Conference.
And if you have any other safety questions, you can always post them to the forum, and we will see them, and we will respond, or try to contact us in person, or come see us tomorrow. Thank you.